Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Ryan Stackhouse. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Serhii Plokhis about his new book, Forgotten Bastards of the Eastern Front, American Airmen Behind the Soviet Lines and the Collapse of the Grand Alliance. Forgotten Bastards is available from Oxford University Press as of 2019, and, as some of you will no doubt already be aware, not the first time that this author has dealt with Soviet history. Serhii has penned many books on the history of Eastern Europe, most notably Chernobyl, History of a Tragedy, which was awarded the 2018 Bale Gifford Prize. Forgotten Bastards, I am pleased to say, is another captivating window into Soviet society. Plokhis tells the story of the short-lived shuttle bombing operations during the Second World War, when American airmen operated B-17s out of Soviet airfields in the present-day Ukraine. Sifting through countless memoirs and, most interestingly, declassified secret police files, Plokhis captures what it was to be alive at this extraordinary moment in time when Americans and Soviets lived and fought alongside one another, all without losing sight of the bigger picture. Forgotten Bastards of the Eastern Front is many things, above all, a pleasure to read, and we are fortunate enough to have Serhii with us here today to chat about his new book. So, without further ado, Serhii, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on your show. It's a pleasure.
To begin with today, what was it that brought you to the study of history?
I was always interested in local history. So I started as a historian of the region where I grew up, and that was a Cossack region in southern Ukraine. And then slowly I became interested in the history of the world. I grew up during the Cold War, so the American history was something that fascinated me as well. And this book that we are discussing today, it actually brings together two of the themes that always interested me. First of all, the history of the region where I grew up, which is Ukraine, and then American history, also my country, and I'm a proud American citizen now. So it's really bringing my old homeland and new homeland together in an episode in the middle of the Second World War that I really knew nothing about when I grew up in at the time of the Cold War. No one ever mentioned that there were American airmen in my backyard on the territory of Ukraine. So for me, it was a major, major discovery. And again, I was really more than happy to share what I found in the archives, what I found in the memoirs with broader readership.
How did you come to write this book specifically? Because you'd done this previous work on Chernobyl. I was wondering if it popped up perhaps in the same archives where you're digging around.
Well, you're absolutely correct. The key element, something that persuaded me to write about that story, was the opening of the archives in Ukraine after the Revolution of Dignity. So the major protests that took place in Ukraine in the year 2014. And it resulted in the opening of many archives, including former KGB archives. And given that the three air bases that are discussed in the book. They were on the territory of Ukraine. So now we can go to Kyiv and found in the former KGB archives two type of documents. The first type comes from the Red Army military counterintelligence, which was called Death to the Spies, Smerch or Smerch Shpionam. And then another institution that with documents and archives of which I worked was the People's Commissariat of the State Security, and that was the secret police that was responsible for monitoring the local population. And in our case, that was the population that got in touch, in contact with the Americans. So I read about the American air bases before, and there are a couple of really very good books about that, but written exclusively on the basis of the American military archives. And now, for the first time, we got an opportunity to see the other side of the story, how that story was perceived and how the Americans were treated by the Stalin's regime.
So what is the big picture that you want people to take away from this book? What do you want them to walk away thinking about?
Well, the book is about individual people and their experiences, and there is a lot of, in terms of human stories, but there is also a bigger argument and contribution to our discussion about what went wrong after the end of the Second World War, why the former allies became adversaries, why we got the Cold War that lasted for ever and a half since late 1940s until the fall of the Soviet Union in late 80s, early 90s. And the book tries to answer that particular question as well. And the answer is that the tensions that eventually resulted in the Cold War, they started already during World War II, and they started in particular on those bases, the only place where Americans and the Soviets were fighting side by side. And what the Americans really never accepted was what I call a police state, a state in which the surveillance is a daily occurrence, where the state interferes in the personal lives of people, where the Soviet secret police was interrupting dating or relationship that were developing between the American airmen and local women, or was trying to use those women to spy on the Americans, where lies was basically part of the official policy of the state. None of that was acceptable for the U.S. airmen. And most of them, the absolute majority, came to the Soviet Union really fascinated about the mission, really having high opinion about their Soviet ally. And almost all of them actually left being disappointed, and some of them being sworn enemies of the regime. So the origins of the Cold War really in World War II, and really the bottom line, what was in conflict, what came in conflict at those bases were the principles that are behind liberty on one hand and really tyranny on another.
It is really impressive the way you managed to capture these everyday scenes that just bring everything into such sharp relief. But we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves there. You raise the curtain on 1943. The war is turning, but by no means is victory certain yet. We find Foreign Minister Molotov standing on the tarmac at Moscow airport with a brass band. Why? What is the plan that he's there to negotiate?
Well, at that particular moment in war, the allies were trying to figure out how to win the war. It's already after Stalingrad, after a major battle in central Russia, in Kursk, the tank battle, the biggest tank battle of the war. And what is ahead is the D-Day, is the opening of the second front in Europe. And that's what really the Soviets want the Allies to do. And Molotov is welcoming American Secretary of State at that time, and also the Foreign Secretary of Britain, to engage them in the discussion, prepare first a big three meeting in Tehran that happened later in the year, in 1943, and then eventually coordinate activities that would result in D-Day. And to achieve that goal, the Soviets are trying to be as pleasant, as nice to the Allies as possible. They do a lot of things. One of those things was that they dissolved the Communist International, really the headquarters in Moscow that was running the communist parties all over the world and very often engaged in activities against states, including allied states. They also allowed really a rebirth of the Russian Orthodox Church to present a better image of the Soviet Union on the international arena. That's what is at stake at that point, at least for the Soviets. That's what Molotov is thinking about.
Well, negotiations for some type of cooperation on shuttle bombing do not go smoothly, to put it mildly. What was involved in just making this entire mission come together, and why were there so many roadblocks?
It's interesting why the Americans, in particular American Air Force, comes with the idea of creating those air bases on the Soviet territory. But they are preparing also for landing in Europe. They are preparing for D-Day, and they consider that it's really very important to have a complete mastery of the skies, and to destroy Luftwaffe before D-Day comes. To do that, they have to not just to shut down as many German airplanes in the skies as possible, but also to destroy the infrastructure, to destroy the factories that produce those airplanes, to destroy the oil refineries. And a lot of that stuff was built by the Germans, either in Eastern Germany or in Eastern Europe, in Poland. Oil was coming, for example, from Hungary and Romania. The U.S. at that time had wonderful bombers, the B-17 Flying Fortresses, but they lacked in 1943 the fighter planes that would be able to take off from the airfields, let's say in Britain or later in Italy, and escort bombers on their raid to Eastern Europe and then come back to Britain. So because they didn't have fighter planes, and that means that B-17 were vulnerable without protection, they decided that shuttle bombing can help. So let's say the bombers and escort fighter planes take off from the airfields in Britain. They bomb their targets in Eastern Europe. They land on the Soviet territory, get refueled, get new ammunition, and then fly back and bomb those targets as well. So that was the idea. And the American ambassador, Averell Harriman, the General John Dean, who was the chief officer in the U.S. military mission in Moscow, they were really working hard trying to sell this idea to Stalin and to Molotov. And Soviet leaders actually were, as you mentioned, were very reluctant. The main reason was the ideological and cultural insecurity of the Soviet state. They considered allies, first of all, to be temporary allies. They considered them to be capitalists. They considered that they can somehow contaminate or can be infectious when it comes to the contacts between the Soviet citizens and Americans. And they also didn't trust allies. They were really the products of the thinking that came out of the Russian Revolution of 1917, where there were military bases on the Soviet territory. And Molotov at some point said that, okay, it's easier to get those foreign air bases, but it would be difficult to get rid of them. So the bottom line is just mistrust on all levels, political, ideological, and otherwise, of what the allies, the Western allies, the American in particular, goals in the war were. So there was little trust to start with.
Well, Stalin finally relents in late 1943, and an air base is established at Poltava. What was involved in the construction, and what do the Americans and Soviets make of each other at first blush?
Well, Stalin really eventually gives go-ahead, and the main reason for that is that, as I mentioned before, he wants to be nice to the Allies because he wants the opening of the Second Front. And really, the first shuttle bombing raid and the first American flying fortresses landed on the air bases in Ukraine a few days before D-Day. And once that goal is achieved by the Soviets, then the enthusiasm and the interest is really not there. It is diminishing. But before that happened, there was really couple weeks of really very happy relationship between the allies. I already mentioned that the American participants of that operation had held their Soviet counterparts in high regard, given their war effort and contribution to the war. And the Soviets, without interference from the secret police and with the party and state officials given green light for working together with the Americans, were really very, very friendly. You look at the memoirs and correspondence from the American side. They were working really very nice with the military commanders, in particular the Soviet Air Force military commanders. They got a lot of support there. They got a lot of cooperation. Those military men on both sides, they understood each other really, really very well. So it's the relations were good maybe for month and a half. But once the Second Front was there, once there happened something that was really very embarrassing for the Soviets, and that's the bombing of the by Luftwaffe of the American airplanes on the airfields, and the Soviets couldn't protect that. The Soviets lost interest in the project and wanted the Americans out.
Before we get to Pearl Harbor on the steppes, I was hoping you could give us a bit more first about the relationship as the operations actually begin. Planes finally start arriving in May 1944. What is the mood on the base surrounding these first missions?
Oh, it's jubilation. It's jubilation. For the first time, really, in the history of the Grand Alliance, the two allies, Americans and the Soviets, are fighting together. Again, the Grand Alliance was a very particular, I would say, strange alliance in which the British and the Americans were fighting on the same front, but the Soviets were also on the other front, on the Eastern Front. There was a lot of cooperation, but very little common participation in the operation. That particular operation, which was called Frantic, was an exception, and everyone was extremely happy. The Averell Harriman, American ambassador, came from Moscow to greet the American airplanes. Luckily for us, his daughter, Kathleen Harriman, convinced her father to take her along. And then she described all those things in letters to her sister back in the United States. Probably we would not know certain things about that operation if it wouldn't be for Kathleen Harriman. And again, there is this excitement that's shared by both sides. Then a few days later, news come about opening of the Second Front in France. And again, it's something that's celebrated by both sides. So again, it's really a honeymoon was short, but as long as it lasted for a few weeks, there was a lot of cooperation and a lot of goodwill between the Americans and the Soviets.
Things start to break down even before there's a real military disaster to put stress on the relationship. What are the points of friction?
Well, the biggest thing is the so-called Dayton rights for the Americans, and that becomes obvious in the summer of 1944. So the American airmen, once they came to Poltava and other regions, other two bases in Ukraine, they were warned that they were not allowed to date Soviet women in uniform. But they were allowed to date the local women, the civilians, and originally things were developing quite nicely and quite well. But once the Soviets decided that they didn't want the Americans there anymore, what you see is that the secret police is actually attacking those women, attacking them in the presence of their American dates. And you see fights, happening and going on between the Red Army officers or the secret police officers and the Americans as well. So that was a big issue there. Another issue was also that the Soviets wanted to limit the contacts that the Americans would have with the locals and with Red Army officers and soldiers to the minimum. So they would not really allow much the Americans to go into the cities and to the villages. Instead, they created a so-called restaurants on the base where the Americans could buy certain supplies and alcohol and so on and so forth. The problem was that most of the salary that the American soldiers and officers were getting was not reaching them. It was going on their accounts back in the United States. And that created also buying disparity between the Americans and the Soviets that also didn't contribute in a positive way to the development of relationship. But there were also some cultural differences, and the big thing for the Americans, especially for the medical personnel, was the conditions in which the canteen was operated, or the conditions in the Soviet toilets that were there. So somehow that was part of the everyday routine that the Soviets didn't pay much attention to, pretended that the problem was not there, and that appalled Americans. So there were minor frictions here and there, but again, the really things started to deteriorate once the Soviet government decided that it didn't want the Americans there.
Smersh seems to pick up its activity in step with the shift of the Soviet leadership's attitudes towards the Americans. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the sources that you're working through when you're looking at this, because they establish a network throughout the base to keep tabs on people. How do they build this?
Well, SMERSH is a military counterintelligence, and it was created really with one purpose, and the purpose was to fight against possible German penetration and possible German agents, either within the ranks of the Red Army or in the rear, in the Soviet rear. What we see different this time around is that it's the same counterintelligence organization that is now working not against the Germans, not against the enemy, but works against the Allies, works against the Americans. And they sent from Moscow a special officer, a high-ranking officer that would be overseeing those operations. And they dramatically increase the number of the agents or informers that they had in the ranks of the Red Army, especially among those who had day-to-day contacts with the Americans. But even people like mechanics and others on the Soviet side, they were instructed, for example, one of the instructions that they got was to count the number of people that come on the airplanes to be sure that the Americans would not smuggle back to Europe anybody from the Soviet territory. And one of the first things that SMERSH does, it arrests people who are trying to establish contact with the Americans, and those people would have some families or background, or would grow up in the United States, and then as children, mostly of the communists would come to the Soviet Union. So the SMERSH was there treating the Americans as a potential enemy, really.
The initial missions have gone smoothly, and despite these growing tensions that you're outlining, things are still more or less working. Then we have Pearl Harbor on the steps. What happened, and how did it shape the relationship?
What happened was that after the so-called Frantic 2, so the second shuttle bombing mission, arrived to the bases, the same day, the same night, Luftwaffe really did very, very daring operations. So they bombed the Poltava air base, and most of the airplanes that were there on the ground were either destroyed or damaged. And the Soviets, on the one hand, they were trying their best to protect their guests. What that meant was that the anti-aircraft fire was going on, the fighter jets were in the air, but they actually failed to do anything to Luftwaffe. Luftwaffe didn't lose one single plane, which was a major embarrassment for the Soviets and for the Soviet command. The reason why that happened was not any kind of a cowardice or lack of bravery on the part of the Soviets, but the fact that they were ill-equipped to fight back a night attack. So they didn't have, for example, their airplanes were not equipped with radars, which meant that during the nighttime they were basically useless. Their anti-aircraft crews were not trained enough, and so on and so forth. So it was quite embarrassing for the Soviets. When the attack ended, what happened was that the Soviets really were trying their best to save the American airplanes. Today, on the territory of that air base in Poltava, there is a monument to the people who died in that attack on June 22nd, 1944. So there were two Americans who were killed, and over 20 Soviet officers and soldiers. Most of them were killed when they were trying actually to save the American airplanes from and put down fire and so on and so forth. So the Soviets tried, but again, it was a major disaster from the American point of view. You mentioned Pearl Harbor on the steps. That's the title of the chapter in the book. And Pearl Harbor, that's how some of the American officers really talked about what happened at Poltava, because that was the second largest loss of the American airplanes on the ground since the battle, since Pearl Harbor. Given that the second front was already there, Given that the front line, the Soviet front line, was moving further toward the west, the embarrassment on the Soviet part with that air raid on the Poltava air base contributed to the growing tensions between the Allies.
By August, the losses have been replenished and Poltava is once again operational. However, you write that the differences had multiplied during this time. What went wrong, both interpersonally on the base and geopolitically in the alliance?
Well, geopolitically, what happened was that in August of 1944, the Red Army reached the outskirts of Warsaw. And at that time, an uprising, anti-German uprising, started in Warsaw. And Stalin refused really to help the rebels. He refused to help the rebels because they were under overall command of the exile Polish government with headquarters in London. And Stalin had his own plans for Poland, and he wanted to make it communist, so he didn't want the capital of the country, Warsaw, to end up in the hands of West forces that were allied with the West, not with him. There were some good reasons why Stalin couldn't help, because by the time the Red Army reached Warsaw, communication lines were really extended, the troops were exhausted, and the Germans were able to put together quite an impressive counteroffensive at that time. And the Western Allies understood that. So what was suggested first by Churchill and then by Roosevelt as well was said, okay, we understand that your troops can't help Warsaw, but please allow us to use air bases in Ukraine, Poltava in particular, for our airplanes to do airdrops for the Polish rebels. And Stalin refused to do that, which came as a major, major surprise, but also blow to the trust and the goodwill of the Soviets. That was a turning point, for example, for Avril Harriman, U.S. ambassador in Moscow, in terms of his attitude towards Stalin and the Soviet Union. And the same is true, as I show in my book, for quite a few American airmen on those bases in Ukraine. So geopolitically, the situation is not good. And Stalin, after that, decides, okay, the bases should go. On the ground, what is happening at that time, Americans understand and realize that they're not welcome anymore. So they're really waiting for the end of that operation. The morale is falling, the discipline is falling, so there are much more conflicts between the Americans and the Soviets. So really, by the time that the most of the airmen are ordered out of the Soviet Union, that happens in September of 1944, they're really fed up. They don't want to stay there. The out of three bases, one base was left operational, the base in Poltava, where they left kind of a skeleton crew of around 200 people. But those officers and airmen, they had already a very different mission from the original one. There was no shuttle bombing anymore going on. And they came with a name for themselves. They called themselves Forgotten Bastards of Ukraine. And that's was also an inspiration for the title of the book, which is Forgotten Bastards of the Eastern Front.
The future Poland very much becomes the pivot on which the entire relationship turns. How is all of this tension playing out over the winter and into the new year? I mean, the end is approaching, defeat is imminent, and yet Poltava is still figuring at the center of these negotiations.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It's difficult to overestimate the importance of Poland and Eastern Europe in relations between the Allies in late 44 and then in 1945. Stalin did his best not to allow either Americans or British or any representatives of the Western allies to be in Eastern Europe and to see what was going on, where he was waging the war not only against the Germans, but also against the pro-democratic forces, and in particular the Polish so-called Home Army, the people who were behind the Warsaw Uprising. And under those circumstances, Poltava Air Base and those 200 people who stayed there, they were basically the forepost, the I call it watchtower for the U.S. and for the Western allies, and the main source of information about what was going in Eastern Europe, in Poland in particular. The reason for such a role that Poltava started to play, Poltava Air Base, was that the Soviets allowed airmen from Poltava to fly to Western Ukraine, to Eastern Poland, to help the American crews of the American airplanes that were forced to land on the Soviet territory as the result of this war, in the air war over Eastern Europe. So some of the planes had technical problems, others were maybe damaged in the battle, were shot at. And they were going to the city of Lviv, they were going to some areas in today's Eastern Poland, and they were bringing this information about really the Soviets, first of all, moving the border and establishing their control over parts of Eastern Poland. And beyond that, also waging the war against the or the military forces that were loyal to the democratic government in London. And this issues about who has the right and who doesn't have the right to be in Eastern Europe became a very important topic that was discussed at the Yalta Conference in February of 1945. And it's interesting that the Poltava airmen were on the American side, the people who were in charge of bringing Roosevelt and other members of the American delegation to the Crimea. So the air bases in the Crimea where Roosevelt landed, Churchill landed, from the American side, they were run by the personnel from Poltava.
So we finally come to the rupture after Yalta and all of these discussions about how to handle POWs. Relations have been souring for so long. What brought them to a head at this point?
Well, again, we are going back here. Chronologically, we are moving forward, but in terms of thinking about what is happening, I would suggest that we would return to the summer of 1944 and talk about the differences in political culture between the two allies. What happens in the spring of 1945 is that the Red Army is moving into Poland, into Hungary, and they overrun a number of German concentration camps. And among the inmates, among the prisoners of war, are American and British soldiers and officers. And the Americans are trying actually to get those people as soon as possible back to their bases in Britain and eventually back to the United States. And they ask the Soviets to help with that. And the Soviets sign agreements in that regard at Yalta. But then really take no care of the American prisoners of war. So those people are suffering, they are ill, they left hungry, the conditions that they found when they're in the custody of the Red Army are awful. So many of them leave those camps that were created by them for them by the Red Army and go on their own, really, on train, on any way they can to Moscow or to try to get to Poltava. That is, again, why I mentioned political culture, is that in the Soviet mind, the prisoner of war is a traitor. So the Soviet soldiers who were taken as prisoners of war were treated that way. Many of them were arrested, exiled. Attitude toward the prisoners of war was completely different in the American case and in the Soviet case. And part of the story where Poltava and our airmen become part of that story is when Roosevelt wants Stalin once again to allow to use Poltava base to bring in all those Americans from Eastern Poland, from Western Ukraine, from those areas where the camps were liberated, to bring to Poltava. And Stalin again refuses to do that because he doesn't want any Americans, any foreigners on the territory that he controls now and where he wants to install his own regime and his own government. And that leads really to a major breakdown in relations between the Soviet Union and the United States at the highest level. The harshest words that Roosevelt ever said with regard to Stalin, and when I say said, means sent to him as part of his telegrams, are coming from March of 1944 and are dealing with the fate of the American prisoners of war. And again, Poltava is a very important part of that story because some of those people who were saved, they're flown from Lviv, from other parts in Western Ukraine to Poltava and were eventually then flew to Iran and ended up in American custody. It's another important part of the story where really the Soviet police state meets the American political culture, which is basically democratic and which treats prisoners of war really as heroes, as opposed to treating them as cowards and traitors.
The Soviet attitude toward American commissioned and other ranks relations was also quite entertaining. I believe it was the head of SMERSH who wrote the report about the party that they went to together.
Oh, yes, yes. it was a costume party that the American mostly officers threw, and they were trying to entertain themselves. They were trying also to entertain their Soviet guests. But that was considered to be something completely not appropriate by the Soviets, the way how Hitler was portrayed there, how the officers were dressed. So it's very interesting again in terms of the official facade, in terms of the official pronouncements. The Soviet regime is a very Puritan regime that rejects many parts of kind of a more liberal relationship, including relationship between different sexes. But that is on the surface. But in reality, what happens is that you look at the number of women that were raped when the Red Army moved, especially into Eastern Europe and then into Germany. So it's a Puritan on the surface, and then really on many levels very immoral in terms of the practices that regime consciously or unconsciously encouraged. So it was really very, very, very funny to read that report about bad morals and bad behavior of the Americans when it was part of a really, again, a costume party, and there was a lot of humor there.
It really highlights the underlying conflict so well that you're talking about as we turn to the end of the book, where you begin to look at the transition from the Grand Alliance to the emerging Cold War. You write that Soviet-American encounters which began at Poltava, continued in Berlin. How so?
The main reason for that was that despite of being allies for so long, there was very little contact between the Soviet and American military. And those relationships that were in Poltava between the American officers and the Soviets, they were really on their respective sides. They were experts. The Americans who were at Poltava were experts on the Soviet Red Army, and vice versa is true for the Soviets. So those cadres were used by both sides when they had to negotiate the politics in Berlin and in Germany, where Germany, again, was jointly occupied by the Soviet Union and Western allies, and the same was true for Berlin. So those cadres who on both sides had already experience in dealing with each other, they were also brought to Berlin. So again, in that sense, the Poltava story gets its continuation in Berlin. But again, it's already a different stage. And the Americans in particular, they don't have also the illusions, the kind of illusions that they had when they first came to the Soviet Union in 1943. It's really the beginning already of the Cold War. And for many of them, it's already started in Poltava and now it's brought to Berlin.
The same old suspicions of anyone who had developed friendly relations at Poltava, especially women, keep rearing their head over the years. You trace the fate of several women who dated Americans on the base through the 40s and 50s. Could you tell us a bit about this, as you style it, a witch hunt?
Yes. Well, it's really a sad story. Some of these women were harassed and then followed or were under surveillance of the KGB all the way into the 1960s. And the once the Cold War really reached its peak in the early 1950s, the Soviet secret police was on the lookout for the American spies. And those poor women, they were right in the middle, right in the center of the attention of the secret police. They were interrogated, they were recruited, and most of the time recruited to spy on their friends who also were dating Americans. And there were also situations in which they tried to use these women to establish contacts or reestablish contacts with the Americans who already after the Second World War, of course, came back to the U.S. and were living there. I have a couple of such stories there. One of them is about the American officer of Russian extraction with the Italian last name. His name was Igor Reverditto, and he was dating one of the women in my story. And then she was recruited in the 1950s and was forced to write letters to the U.S. trying to figure out where he was. Igor Reverditto spoke Russian, and like quite a few people who spoke Russian, was suspected just on the basis of that of being a spy. Another story involves a person who later became a quite prominent academic and got his degrees from Harvard. His name was George Fisher. And George Fisher, for a short period of time, either met a woman or was dating a woman. And again, he was considered he was at the top of the list of suspected spies. He never was a spy. FBI actually suspected him for a while of working for the other side, working for the Soviets. But it's a continuation of the story of a police state and women who were unlucky to date Americans were then viewed as potential American spies. Lives of some of them was destroyed by this.
You mentioned Fisher. He's a fascinating figure throughout this. Was that a case of serendipity? Was there a collection of his files at Harvard, or did he just pop up and the school connection just was there in the background?
Well, he is very prominent in the files of the former KGB files in Kyiv. Mm-hmm. So I never heard about him before I looked at those files. Then I started to try to figure out, like with anybody else, who that was, and then I discovered that absolutely fascinating story of an American academic who was born in Berlin. Grew up in Moscow because his father was a leftist journalist, and he parked his family in the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 1930s. And then that family got out of the Soviet Union only after the help of Eleanor Roosevelt. They wouldn't let them out. And eventually, George Fisher really ends at Harvard. So again, that was a big surprise. There is another figure in my story who also ended at Harvard. That was Franklin Holtzman. And again, I established contacts with the families of some of these people, main characters in my book. So with sons of Franklin Holtzman, this month, actually it will be on November 12th, we are going to have at Harvard roundtable on the book, but also on Franklin Holtzman, and his sons are going to take part in that roundtable. I also met younger brother of George Fisher, Vic Fisher, absolutely very, very interesting person, one of the drafters of the Constitution of Alaska, whom I met when I visited Alaska. Son of Igor Riverdito, Tony Riverdito. So all of these stories that started in the KGB archives in Kyiv eventually brought me to the United States and put in touch with some really very interesting people.
And the FBI archives when it comes to Fisher's case.
Oh, yes, yes. FBI files. It was really, really something that I didn't expect to find, but when you can get both KGB and FBI files on the very same person, you start thinking, what an irony of the situation. And again, that's one of the realities of the Cold War, when people who were either caught in the middle or put themselves in the middle were under suspicion by both sides.
It's also another one of those great windows into how the two different systems approach suspects. Just another great little vignette. But on that note, you draw the book to a close using the history of Poltava as a lens to view those differences between systems. We've talked about the book. Everything's laid out on the table. Any points you want to underline for us again?
Again, it's as I mentioned earlier, there is a big argument regarding the World War II, the Grand Alliance, and the start of the Cold War, but it is there. I arrived to that argument through looking at the lives and life stories of those people. They're very real people. Their families are still around. Their children are around. So it was a very interesting experience for me. Again, it's the sources led me to the people, and then people's stories led me to that broader conclusion and argument and contribution to a bigger academic debate.
Well, it certainly makes for excellent reading, and I heartily recommend it to everyone out there. But what are we looking to you next? I presume you're not slowing down.
yes, and once again, it's the declassified archives, the KGB archives from Kyiv, that really suggested a topic for me. And what I'm working on now is a history of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and again try to introduce the Soviet sources and the Soviet perspective on that coming from those archives, because one thing that probably we don't think about or don't know about is that every single missile that was delivered to Cuba back in 1962 was built in what is today an independent state of Ukraine, which is now in the news for different reasons.
True.
80% of all the troops and all supplies that went to Cuba went through the Black Sea ports in Ukraine, and that means that the local KGB archives have a lot of really interesting and fascinating material on the Cuban Missile Crisis. So you sometimes find these documents and stories and people in most unexpected places, and I found this new information, a new angle on the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis in the archives in Kyiv.
Well, I look forward to having you back when the time comes.
We'll be happy to be back.
All right. Well, we look forward to it. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Ryan. And thanks for this conversation.
Well, that does it for us here at New Books in History. Once again, we've been chatting with Serhii Plokhii about Forgotten Bastards of the Eastern Front, American Airmen Behind the Soviet Lines, and the Collapse of the Grand Alliance. Forgotten Bastards is available from Oxford University Press at a price that is as reasonable as the book is readable. Any of you out there interested in social history of the trenches, with a strong emphasis on human interest, will thoroughly enjoy reading about the characters anchoring this narrative. With that, I'd like to thank you for joining us, and hope to see you next time. Until then.